Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Republicans in Congress say New York Governor Kathy Hochul isn't doing enough to enforce immigration laws. WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports.
Hochul and two other Democratic governors were grilled for more than 5 hours by the GOP-controlled House Oversight Committee. Representative Elise Stefanik, a Republican from the North Country, is considering a run against Hochul next year. Stefanik asked Hochul about undocumented immigrants arrested for high-profile crimes.
We deserve a governor who stands up for law-abiding New Yorkers, doesn't put illegals first, but actually puts New Yorkers first. I appreciate
rather than going after the viral moment, I suggest you look at the facts.
Hochul says the state cooperates with ICE. She's also ordered state employees not to ask about people's immigration status in most cases. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
New York Congressman Mike Lawler defended his vote for President Trump's big, beautiful bill at a town hall Sunday night. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King was there and filed this report.
The reason I voted in favor of it.
Lawler, a Republican who is considering a run for governor in 2026, has been hosting combative town halls across the 17th District in recent months. Sunday's event at Mayo Pack High School largely focused on Trump's tax and budget policy bill, which some Democrats have alternately coined the Big Ugly. It would extend and expand tax cuts enacted by Trump in his first term, slash spending on programs like SNAP and Medicaid, and boost spending for defense and deportation efforts. It's now in the Senate after passing the House in May. Lawler says he voted for the bill largely for its tax provisions, including a no-tax rule on tips and overtime, an expansion of the child tax credit, and a lift on the cap for state and local tax deductions, or SALT. Under the bill, the SALT cap would raise from $10,000 to $40,000 for filers making up to $500,000 a year.
The $40,000 cap will make it so that roughly 90% of the district will be able to fully deduct their state and local taxes on their federal income tax return.
Some Democrats have dismissed the tax provisions of the bill as favoring wealthier Americans and corporations. While Sunday's town hall was heated, Lawler appeared to have more supporters in the audience than at previous events. Mixed in with the boos was a fair amount of applause, especially when Lawler talked about taxes, his support for Trump's antagonism of college campuses, and his support for immigration and customs enforcement. Carmel Town Councilman Robert Kearns was among his supporters.
He was voted the fourth most bipartisan congressman in Congress, and I truly believe that he does a fantastic job of working across the aisle.
But despite rules aimed at restricting participants from protesting, shouting, or even standing at the event, a large portion of the crowd was there to express their objections to Lawler and the current administration. Lawler maintains the Big Beautiful Bill does not actually decrease the federal government's share toward base Medicaid costs, but it would add new work requirements starting in 2029, which would inevitably cause some people to lose coverage. Veteran Joe Mayhew says he remembers being on Medicaid 40 years ago after he was honorably discharged from the Air Force and struggling to find work. He says if these kinds of work restrictions were in place then, he would have been down on his luck.
Now I have relatives that are also on Medicaid, and they work. But some of them are seasonal work. Some of it independent contractor work. So what happens? The weather is bad one day, so the job shuts down. Or they get sick. They could literally lose their medical benefits because 1 month they couldn't make that 80 hours. That's like evil.
I'm asking you, do you understand how detrimental the overall proposal cuts to Medicaid?
Mayhew was one of the dozen or so attendees who got to pose their thoughts to Lawler. Lawler says, like other programs, the work requirements would be waived for anyone who can prove they are ill or actively seeking work.
The people who Medicaid is intended long term are those within the IDD community. Nothing on traditional Medicaid is touched in this bill. So the bottom line is, of the 3+ million people who are able-bodied and not working, the objective is to get them into the workforce.
Just one thing.
Yep.
There isn't a system that works. It does not work, and for you, because I have relatives going through this now, vote no until this system works. It doesn't work right now.
Some of the more heated moments of the night came when Lawler touted his ability to work with Democratic lawmakers, saying what they do is, quote, not personal. At one point, a constituent asked Lawler where he stood on the ongoing protests against ICE in Los Angeles. Trump has deployed the National Guard to confront protesters against Governor Gavin Newsom's wishes. Lawler says he agrees with the decision, just as he would have liked to have seen the Guard deployed sooner in the Capitol attack on January 6th. He alleges the two are not so different.
Let me ask you a question. How many of you, by show of hands, how many of you would like these folks to spit in the faces of ICE agents? Okay. How many of you are okay with them barricading law enforcement and trying to block them from doing their job? Okay. See, here's the difference. I oppose January 6th, and those who physically assaulted law enforcement officers should have been prosecuted and should not have been pardoned. The difference is you all just said you don't agree with that with respect to these protesters.
Lawler has not hesitated to goad the audience at his events. At one point Sunday, he called a constituent a, quote, five-year-old for shouting from the crowd. Speaking with WAMC, Rockland County resident Lily Chapin says she was disappointed but not surprised by how the night went down.
It is personal for a lot of people when they're losing their health care. It's personal when my 14-year-old niece accidentally got tear gas today in Los Angeles because she and her dad just wanted to go watch what was happening downtown. That's personal.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with Blair Horner, Senior Policy Advisor for the New York Public Interest Research Group, to talk about pending environmental legislation in the legislature.
Just to put it in some context for the listeners, I mean, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation put out a report in December 2023. It was called a Solid Waste Management Plan. And in that, they describe the problem that the state of New York is facing when it comes to disposing of municipal solid waste. Landfills are filling up. You can't build more incinerators because they burn things. Burn things lead to greenhouse gas emissions. And so what should you do? And the DEC says the New York, and the rest of the country certainly, but certainly New York, has to move to what's called a circular economy, where the waste that's produced is the responsibility largely of those who produce the packaging waste. And so the bill that you're describing, the packaging bill, is a way to do that, is a way to encourage recycling, reduce the use of toxics in packaging, and to reduce the burden on New York State's municipal solid waste system. And so the legislation, as you and I are talking now, you're right, it's passed the Senate. It's now, you know, like hand-to-hand combat on the floor of the Assembly. Yeah. We don't know how that's going to work out yet, but, you know, we believe we have the votes, and we certainly believe that we have the rationale that makes sense as to why it's needed.
Well, and Blair, you must like the idea, because we don't often see this. You know, they pass these sort of mandates or laws, and then they don't have any enforcement. I see they're going to establish, if it passes, a new Office of Inspector General to ensure the companies fully comply.
Yeah, I mean, sort of the basic philosophic underpinning of the legislation is that the companies will be responsible for the waste, and the companies will have a lot of latitude to figure out how to comply, because, you know, we're talking about all different kinds of packaging. But to make sure that there's public accountability, there would be an entity established by the government to monitor what they're doing and to make sure that they're meeting the goals that are set in the bill, as well as that they're behaving in a way that's not just enriching themselves at the expense of the public.
Which, Blair, is exactly what's happening on the national level. The Trump administration is getting rid of regulations in every possible spot.
Well, and they fired all the inspector generals. So at the federal level, again, it's a huge difference between what the state of New York talks about doing and does and what currently the federal government is debating and does. And the gap couldn't be wider. So that being said, Americans will get a chance to vote on that in 2026, what they think about what's happening in Washington. And they will get a chance to vote on what they see in New York come 2026 when they see how that's all happening. That's what elections are for. And so, you know, we'll see what Americans want to do. We'll see what New Yorkers want to do in those elections. But it's a huge difference. There's no doubt about it. And the sort of like the federal approach of punishing alternative energy sources like wind and solar and trying to, reinvigorate fossil fuel power like coal and oil is based on a false analysis that says that there's no such thing as climate change, which is just ridiculous. Now, New York State has
not only ridiculous, it's an all out lie.
Well, yeah, it's ridiculous and it is a lie. Yes, that's right. I mean, it is. There's no, you can measure temperature. We have conquered the thermostat and we know that the planet is getting hotter. There's no getting around it. And the world's experts all talk about why. The industry's known for 50 years why it was going to happen. So you got to do something about it. Trump administration, the Congress doesn't want to do anything about it. They want to stick their head in the sand, which will accelerate catastrophe. In New York, we have laws in the books, you know, and sometimes it's dragging their feet, but there's laws in the books to try to deal with it. Hopefully, sanity will reign. Hopefully, reliance on science will come back, and maybe we can sort of mitigate the looming and ongoing climate catastrophe that we're all facing. We're all right now breathing in smoke from Canadian wildfires. Yeah. And some of that, of course, is, you know, forest management and everything else. But a lot of it is because it's super dry. And when it's super dry, all it takes is a spark and you got a big fire.
That's Blair Horner, Senior Policy Advisor for the New York Public Interest Research Group. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Wastewater treatment plants are taking sewage sludge from states like Massachusetts and turning it into cheap fertilizer for application in New York. That sludge is made up of human waste and anything else that ends up down the drain, and farmers have been applying it on their fields here in the state. But some state lawmakers are saying not so fast. Jung Yoon Han from the New York Public News Network with more.
It was raining when I stopped by Ryan Dunham's house in New Scotland. There's a streak of foggy mist covering the miles of treeline.
Want me to grab an umbrella?
The rain doesn't bode well for Dunham. His house sits on top of limestone, rough rocks, and tough soil.
So you can imagine any sort of liquid that goes in there is going to go straight down.
And into his water well. His family found that out the hard way back in late May last year while his kids were taking a shower.
The next thing I know, I'm in the house and my 11-year-old's screaming from the bathroom and I come upstairs and the water's brown.
Dunham got his water tested immediately.
And the Department of Health told me that our levels of E. coli and coliform tested 200 times beyond safe levels, as recommended by the EPA.
Around the same time, the farm across the road from Dunham's house began applying sewage sludge onto the fields. Some companies market the stuff as biosolids, but whatever you call it, state lawmakers are asking the question, should sewage sludge be used as fertilizer on New York's farmlands? Basically, sewage sludge is human waste instead of animal waste used as fertilizer. The State Department of Environmental Conservation has even recommended the state more than double how much biosolids are spread on farm fields and parks. But here's the thing about sewage sludge. It's not just human waste from the toilet.
We have a sewer system that pretty much admits just about anything that gets thrown in there.
That's Murray McBride. He's an emeritus professor at Cornell University's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. His research is focused on the other stuff that gets flushed too, like heavy metals and chemicals from factories and industrial waste.
Where we're talking about hundreds and thousands of persistent chemicals.
McBride and other researchers say pharmaceuticals, pathogens, and other toxic compounds end up in sewage sludge and at concerning levels.
Some of them are bioaccumulative in livestock. And so we have a pathway now of exposure of humans to toxic chemicals from the soil to livestock to humans.
Those risks are prompting some lawmakers to propose a statewide pause on sewage sludge application.
Our farmland should not be a dumping ground for our waste.
That's Anna Kellis. She's an assembly member from Ithaca and has a doctorate in nutritional epidemiology. She co-wrote a bill which would stop the spread of biosolids for 5 years. During that time, the state would study the impact of biosolids on the land and the animals and people that live there.
To be clear, this is not a straight out ban. This is saying, okay, we need to understand how bad things are, and when we identify that, we need to start intervening.
Other states have already banned the application of biosolids on land. Maine implemented an outright ban after they conducted studies and found traces of PFAS that were found in biosolids ultimately ended up in dairy milk.
And there were some farms where the accumulation was so high that those farms were shuttered permanently, and that soil, it's forever chemicals. And it'll be thousands of years of, you know, contamination.
But some towns are not too eager about the bill.
I think it's terrible because on so many levels. So
Rick Keneally oversees the town of Webster's wastewater treatment plant system.
I think they're jumping in too deep to say, we're just going to cut it off while we study.
Webster is revamping their water treatment plant by 2026 so that they can produce biosolids. The state even gave Webster $20 million to help out with the project. Keneally says the issue is that factories put out industrial waste that include toxic components, and there should be more regulations on them.
So to put regulations on us that really we can't do anything about, I mean, it's counterproductive to me.
Sewage sludge also solve a few tricky problems that the state's currently facing. For one, landfills are so overrun, the state will probably run out of space for them within about 20 years, according to the DEC. That makes it incredibly expensive for municipalities to dump their waste there. But Keneally says there's also an environmental consideration. He says the logic is if the state diverts this waste from landfills, New York could also potentially recycle it back into the earth full circle.
So those nutrients that we'd be putting back to the earth help grow product that the cows would be eating on.
But even Webster's biosolids aren't without potentially harmful contaminants. Keneally told me the PFOS levels of its biosolids were at 3.7 micrograms per kilogram. That's nearly four times over the EPA's recommended amount for sewage sludge. There's only about a week left for lawmakers to vote on the bill before the legislative session ends, and Denham is anxiously waiting to see what lawmakers do. Albany County, where he lives, has implemented a moratorium on the application of biosolids, but the pause will expire by the end of this year.
I'm still worried about my 11-year-old. She's in the shower singing Taylor Swift, and all I can think about is what water is she ingesting in her body, and how many forever chemicals are in there?
But Denham says he's encouraged. Other places like Schoharie County and even some towns have temporarily banned the practice. And Denham says he hopes the state will follow their lead. Reporting from New Scotland, I'm Jung Yoon Han for the New York Public News Network.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Albany World War I hero Sergeant Henry Johnson's legacy is among the casualties as the Trump administration renames seven military bases. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
In 2023, Louisiana's Fort Polk was renamed Fort Johnson in honor of Albany's own Henry Johnson, a Black Medal of Honor recipient. The Army base had been named for slave owner and Confederate General Leonidas Polk from 1941 until the Biden administration made the change as part of a broader effort to move away from names associated with the former Confederacy. Now the Trump administration is changing base names back, and Fort Johnson will once again be Fort Polk, although it will honor World War II Silver Star recipient General James H. Polk instead of the Confederate general. Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan attended the 2015 White House ceremony when President Barack Obama bestowed the Medal of Honor on Johnson for his actions in World War I, in which he fought off a German advance and rescued a fellow soldier from capture.
As a young man, Henry Johnson joined millions of other African Americans on the great migration from the rural South to the industrial North, a people in search of a better life. He landed in Albany, where he mixed sodas at a pharmacy, worked in a coal yard, and as a porter at a train station. And when the United States entered World War I, Henry enlisted.
June 5th marked the 108th anniversary of Johnson's enlistment in the all-black 369th Infantry Regiment, the Harlem Hellfighters. On Wednesday, a tearful Sheehan said changing the name of the fort is about white supremacy.
There were people who were invited to that ceremony who never thought they would set foot in the White House, much less be in a room with the President of the United States. And it matters. And leaders are called upon to do the right thing. And I am watching Republicans in Washington not only not do the right thing, but allow the rule of law and basic human decency and dignity to be crushed, ignored. And it's not right. And it is. This is not the way that I wanted to spend the last 6 months of being the mayor of this incredible city.
The Democrat is calling for the Department of Defense to reverse the decision. She said medals and monuments in the city honoring Johnson will remain in place. In 2017, Albany began celebrating the annual Henry Johnson Day. The name Fort Johnson was bestowed by the Congressional Naming Commission, formed in 2021 following the racial reckoning that emerged from the 2020 death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. In 2024, WAMC spoke with one of the five commission members, retired Brigadier General Ty Sedgley, who noted the commission made more than 1,000 changes to move away from associations with the Confederacy. He said heroes like Johnson deserve to be commemorated.
Black soldiers in World War I, in fact, many of them, including the Harlem Hellfighters, were given to the French, and they served in French uniforms. And one of the people that we named it after, Henry Johnson, actually was one of the Harlem Hellfighters who fought in French uniform because the American commander, John J. Pershing, did not want those soldiers fighting with him. So this is an ability to recognize true heroes for what they really did and not those who chose the Confederates, who chose treason to preserve slavery.
Johnson also received the French military's highest recognition, the Croix de Guerre. Despite being initially celebrated for his 1918 actions, including leading his regiment's homecoming parade up Fifth Avenue in New York City in February 1919 and sitting down to a dinner with Governor Al Smith, Johnson's heroics were later forgotten by many. Left severely wounded from combat, he died impoverished in 1929. Following advocacy efforts, Johnson was finally awarded the Purple Heart in 1996. An award presented to every American service member wounded in combat. In 2002, Johnson was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, the nation's second highest award for valor.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
Thank you.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2524. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.